You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman, Gallatin Valley Community Radio. Welcome to this special Echotones edition of Forthright Radio for June 17th, 2023. I'm Joy LaClaire. We have been recording and producing daily audio digests of the historic Held v. State of Montana trial brought by 16 youth plaintiffs asserting that their constitutional rights are being violated by the State of Montana, which began on June 12th, 2023, in the Lewis and Clark County District Court in Helena, Montana. Judge Kathy C. presiding. We share the testimony of the final two witnesses for the plaintiffs, Dr. Lisa Van Susteren, an internationally recognized psychiatrist and expert on how climate change affects the physical and mental health of youth differently, and we end with the final words of the plaintiff's case given by youth plaintiff Lander Bussey.
Dr. Van Susteren, we've heard testimony earlier this week from Dr. Lori Byron about how youth are more vulnerable to the physical impacts of climate change. From your mental health perspective, are children uniquely vulnerable to climate change?
Yes, they are, in a number of ways. First of all, kids are dependent on the behavior and decisions, choices of adults. So they have to often submit or respond to or experience all of those decisions. So they're more vulnerable in that way. Whether those decisions are good decisions or bad decisions, they also have brains and bodies that are just developing. And so many of the impacts of extreme weather events, they are very dependent on the impacts of those events. And we can talk about ACEs, which is adverse childhood experiences of children, and where it is well delineated how and why kids are more vulnerable. In addition, a young person has a much longer runway of whatever happens to us as adults from climate trauma and climate issues is certainly sobering and problematic. But it's not going to be the intensity, the frequency, those extreme weather events. And indeed, there is a study which I've mentioned is that children born today are expected to be subjected to at least 7 times the episodes of extreme weather events compared to adults. What's noteworthy is that you can have either acute events. Ideally, if a person or a child is exposed to an acute event, maybe it's a tornado or something, and maybe the feelings over time pass, but of course, maybe they don't. Maybe what happens is that a person, a child, continues to harbor fears about tornadoes, for example, or other weather events. And so it becomes a chronic trauma. But what's especially significant when we talk about traumatic events is exposure to those events are repeated and the most physical and psychological harm.
Let's turn now to discuss some of the specific mental health impacts that can result from climate change.
This is a thumbnail sketch on some of the harms that accrue from climate change impacts on mental health. Starting on the left, extreme weather events. You can have post-traumatic stress disorder. In other words, the stress doesn't just disappear after a climate event, but it persists. And anxiety and depression, pretty clear that people have a range of emotional responses to unexpected challenges from the world around them. And grief and loss. Let's say you lose your house or it's blown away, burned down, flooded. Maybe you lose your possessions, your pets, where you live is disrupted, etc. That's going to create enormous grief and loss. And professionals like me are seeing this in many professional practices. And of course, we're seeing it very much in the literature. High temperature, mood disorders, yes, anxiety, aggressive behavior, increased mortality, of course, among mental health patients. And then long-term climate change. And this is that sense that's where the rubber really hits the road, is when kids are envisioning what's going to happen in the future. It's something I dubbed, I think I said, pre-traumatic stress, but again, we can go into that. This is where you find the most difficulty trying to recover. And then changing livelihoods, resource shortage, disrupted infrastructure. We are seeing these numbers, increased suicide rates, increased violence and crime, reduced community cohesion, worse access to mental health care. I think those are all things that we can deduce as people are no longer finding themselves in the communities that are either there and accessible or functioning.
Is it your understanding that these types of climate impacts that you were just describing are becoming increasingly common in Montana?
Yes.
As a doctor who went to medical school, are you familiar with the physical health impacts of climate change on
Yes.
people? So today we're not here to talk about the physical health impacts, but is there a connection between the physical health impacts and the mental health impacts?
Let me say that I will permit myself at times to talk about the physical impacts because I am a physician. And at times it's important to understand the physical impacts, to understand the psychological impacts. But there is no such thing as physical impacts of climate change alone. Every physical injury, loss, et cetera, carries with it an attendant emotional toll. And of course, when we're distressed emotionally, that can affect us physically. It is a two-way street, and it has been talked about for centuries. The Romans called it mens sana in corpore sano, a healthy mind in a healthy body. And we know this instinctively from our own personal experience.
Did you convene any conferences?
I did. In 2009, I co-convened with the Vice President of the National Wildlife Federation, my good friend Kevin Coyle, a conference which was the effects of global warming in the United States and why the U.S. healthcare system is not prepared. The publication came out in 2012. The psychological effects of global warming on the United States, with the tagline, and why the U.S. mental health care system is not adequately prepared. Global warming in the coming years will foster public trauma, depression, violence, alienation, substance abuse, suicide, psychotic episodes, post-traumatic stress disorders, and many other mental health-related conditions. But in particular, we signaled that at that time, America's 70 million children will not only suffer long-term effects from climate change, but will also experience reactions, acute reactions, to natural disasters and extreme weather events. Of course, this hasn't changed. First of all, there's that famous line, Groucho Marx, that says, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? A number of years ago, it was sometimes hard for people generally to believe that the Earth's climate systems could be turned upside down. But now we're seeing it with our own eyes. The kids have told you this week very compellingly about how their world is different. And they have told us how this is worrisome. We're now finding programs in schools, the curricula, that talk to kids about climate science. They see it on the internet. They do not live in a cave. They know many of these issues. They are very attuned to the fact that of what I and others have referred to as intergenerational injustice, that they are suffering consequences that will be spinning out of their control, and they have firsthand knowledge. In addition, the American Psychological Association, when we had our conference on the global warming in the U.S., the head of the American Psychological Association was there. We had a member of the CDC, not to insist, but a Nobel Prize winner. People were head of the Anxiety Disorders Association of America. Real high-level people. Very sophisticated and knowledgeable. And so I'm particularly grateful to the American Psychological Association for looking at this issue, being willing to listen way back in 2009, and eventually to come out with their own report. Mental health and our changing climate, the impacts, implications, and guidance from the American Psychological Association 2017 publication. It has been widely disseminated and responded to. Climate change, induced extreme weather, changing weather patterns, damaged food and water resources, and polluted air impact human mental health. Increased levels of stress and distress from these factors can also put strains on social relationships and even have impacts on physical health, such as memory loss, sleep disorders, immune suppression, and changes in digestion.
And specifically to kids, what did this report find?
Climate impacts may have long-term and even in permanent effects, such as changing the developmental potential and trajectory of a child.
Was this the only report prepared by the American Psychological Association on climate change?
No, there is an updated version in 2021, which shows you how rapidly evolving and the concern for them to put out another report in such short order. Mental health and our changing climate impacts inequities responses. American Psychological Association 2021.
And were you a contributing author to this report?
I was. The evidence is unequivocal that exposure to climate and weather-related disasters has serious impacts on psychological well-being, and that the chronic impacts of climate change, such as higher temperatures and drought, also have significant negative effects on mental health. Research increasingly points to another psychological outcome of climate change: stress, anxiety, and debilitating worry about the present and future damage of higher global temperatures. There is an abundance of literature in professional organizations of my ilk, meaning mental health, and that this material is reliable and it is of grave concern, and it is showing that our children are at deep risk from the impacts of climate disruption.
Dr. Van Susteren, we've talked about the American Psychological Association. What about the American Psychiatric Association?
The American Psychiatric Association has swung into action, and they are now taking seriously the emotional toll of climate disruption on the mental health of individuals and, of course, young people and children. The American Psychiatric Association has now organized a special committee to study and look at what we should do regarding climate disruption. We have had a number over the last several years of presentations. I've presented it a number of times, and so have my colleagues, to bring the issue of climate and mental health to our colleagues. And we've also been involved in commenting in the media on climate and mental health.
Do you know if the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or the IPCC, has weighed in on the connection between climate change and mental health?
Yes, it has. So since AR5, the previous edition of the IPCC report, new evidence and awareness of current impacts and projected risks of climate change on health, well-being, migration, and conflict have emerged, including greater evidence of the detrimental impacts of climate change on mental health. And it was reached with very high confidence. Climate change is expected to have adverse impacts on well-being and to further threaten mental health, also with very high confidence.
And specifically with respect to children, what did the report find?
Children are particularly vulnerable to climate change impacts. Children and adolescents are particularly vulnerable to post-traumatic stress after extreme weather events. The effects may even be long-lasting, with impacts on their adult functioning.
Do you know if the most recent National Climate Assessment has talked about mental health and climate change?
I am aware, yes.
Describe generally what the National Climate Assessment has found.
As with these other publications, the National Climate Assessment underscores the mental health emotional toll of climate disruption on individuals in the United States, particularly, but it does highlight the impacts on children and that these impacts are prolonged and they are expected to cause over time increased harm to individuals.
Are you familiar with any Montana-specific reports on climate change and physical or mental health?
Yes, of course, climate change and human health, which in Montana, in this publication, also describes the impacts of climate disruption on mental health, harmful impacts, not just the impacts, how harmful the impacts are on our mental health.
And can you talk through a couple of the findings of this report specific to mental health, please?
Sure. The mental health impacts of climate change are profound and varied. Extreme weather events, prolonged heat and smoke, and environmental and societal change all affect mental health, including increasing feelings of disconnectedness and despair.
Would you say there's a scientific consensus that climate change can harm the mental health of people, in particular children and youth?
Indisputably.
Can we start with heat and how increasing heat and temperatures can impact mental health?
First of all, higher temperatures affect our cognition. And it's a fancy word for how well we can use our brains. And what we find is that when people are subjected to higher temperatures, that the accuracy of their work, for example, drops. The speed with which they can accomplish those tasks drops. And the general overall sophistication of their thinking is also compromised. We also know that heat and temperature, and this is a particularly sobering reality, is linked to increased incidence of aggression. And in fact, we have very specific studies that show that for each standard deviation of temperature, and that can be just a couple of degrees, that doesn't have to be a huge variation, we see a 4% rise in violence between individuals and a 14% rise in violence between groups. And that's true of all ethnicities in all regions of the world. So what that means more assaults, more murders, more suicides, and of course, bringing it back home, there's a general problem with us and an irritability factor, an impatience factor. Those are all minimal consequences, but over time, those things, of course, have a cumulative toll. This has been studied very, very carefully. We also see that individuals who have a pre-existing mental health disorder or some kind of mental health challenge see an exacerbation of their conditions. And just from my perspective as a practitioner, I know that we see people who are taking medication oftentimes are more compromised when the temperature goes up. Many of the medications that we take affect our ability to perspire. And so you are more likely to get people afflicted, including heat stroke. And so we've got more people showing up in ERs, et cetera, as they are exposed to higher temperatures. And furthermore, oftentimes population, some at least, who have major medical disorders, you know, their judgment is a little compromised. They don't always know enough to get out of the heat. So it's very widespread impact and deep.
If temperatures do increase in the coming years, do you think that these types of injuries you were just describing will worsen or become more prevalent?
Yes.
A chapter titled Psychological Impacts of Climate Change and Recommendations. Are you the author of this chapter?
I am.
And was this published in the book Health of People, Health of the Planet, and Our Responsibility?
Yes, it was.
Can you just share a couple of the findings of this?
Significant psychological stress is also associated with heat waves. With rising temperatures comes rising rates of aggression. Declining cognitive function could become increasingly problematic for those unable to escape heat.
Are drought conditions associated with any mental health impacts?
Yes, they are. And we can kind of tease out specific mental sort of responses, emotional responses. In general, you can say that anxiety, depression, etc. But there's something peculiarly associated to drought. The consequences are going to get worse. So in addition to all of the general conditions that you can associate with emotional turmoil from unexpected or unpleasant, unwelcome conditions, It's that, just that chronic despair. And it's important because what we are seeing and what has been well studied now is the link to suicide. It is very much in the medical literature. The number of suicides in, for example, farmers in India who are experiencing grievous drought, and ranchers in Western Australia. And those are studies that exist. And of course, people are going to do more research. So we will see increasingly, undoubtedly, the link to self-destructive behaviors.
Is there a connection between wildfires and mental health impacts?
Yes, obviously there is. And wildfires, of course, are particularly traumatic. Without going into the wildfire smoke and how it affects us physically and emotionally, I'll just say the wildfires themselves. I think we saw those photos. I was particularly marked by a photo of Badge standing there with a fire in the hills right behind him. And I was thinking to myself, what would that be like? He was standing in front of his house with his little evacuation rescue packet and wondering if when he turned the next time and returned to his, if he had to evacuate his neighborhood, if it'd be nothing but a moonscape. And the trauma of recognizing that all could be lost in an instant, and to be surrounded by those fears as those hills are on fire, it is a particularly traumatic and enduringly traumatic event.
Does one need to experience an actual loss, say having your home burned down from a wildfire, to have mental health injuries?
Absolutely not. This is what we call secondary trauma. When you see other people suffering from harms, we do experience trauma ourselves. And, you know, we're not potted plants here. Seeing other people suffer is out of empathic identification with a victim. It causes us secondary trauma. So we're not immune just because our own house didn't burn down. And remember, these kids have seen pictures of places that look like a cemetery of chimneys, houses burned to the ground, nothing but the chimney remaining.
Can the threat of loss alone sometimes be enough to cause mental health harms?
Indeed. Now, everybody's a little bit different. But I think that sort of inchoate sense that in the future, bad things are going to happen. You know, it's one thing if you can have an experience and you think, okay, one in a million, this happened. I got to try to figure out how to put it behind me. There's some relief when you realize action's going to be taken. So it helps you to recover and heal. But when you realize, on the contrary, the future, how's the future going to be any different? What assurances are there? Are there any actions being taken that can suggest to me the future is going to be different? So yes, the threat of future harm is particularly grievous. The sense that your life could change on a dime, everything that's familiar. I mean, even salmon's, you know, salmon go upstream to spawn. Home is a pretty important place. And to think that everything that you know, the memories that you have, the experiences with loved ones, maybe pets, and all of your belongings all of a sudden incinerated, and that you have to take a little tiny bag to suggest that your life is going to be now confined to some little space, pretty traumatic.
What about just being surrounded by a wildfire smoke? Can that cause mental health impacts?
Yes, sure. It is very problematic. Wildfire smoke, and we'll get into it in specifically when we look at air pollution. But the wildfire smoke and what it suggests, of course, is that wildfires are surrounding you. And we saw what happened in the northeastern part of the U.S. just recently. What it tells you is that the world is not a safe place. You can't go outside and breathe. The plaintiffs told us over and over again, they can't go outside. And there's nothing as important to our health and our mental health as being able to breathe. I mean, we can go without water longer than we can go without oxygen. We're talking seconds. So it really spawns an enormous amount of anxiety. It makes people feel as if the world is out of control, or it can make them feel as if the world is out of control when that single most important thing that we need as humans is oxygen. people who have respiratory diseases, of course, asthma, et cetera, they are much more vulnerable to the impacts of smoke. And of course, people who are outside typically having fun, just being kids and seeing their friends or engaged in recreational activities, et cetera, can't do it. We saw what happened with COVID when kids were locked up. This is not consistent with psychological health or well-being.
Is there anything else you want to add about air pollution and mental health?
Air pollution in general can cause enormous physical damage in addition to psychological damage. But the wildfire smoke, because it compromised. So here's what's important to look at. And wildfire smoke has especially the ultra-fine particulate matter. And that's what makes up the majority of the particulate matter in wildfire smoke. You can see this diagram shows in black where the impact of that particulate matter is when you breathe it in. It courses through our entire body because it crosses the lungs, goes into the bloodstream, and then it also goes up your nose, takes a ride on the nerves in the nose, and goes directly into the brain and causes neuroinflammation. So here's what we see, and I'll talk first about the neuroinflammation and the brain impacts, and then I'll just repeat a little bit about physical impacts. But what is, first of all, when it goes through the entire body, anytime you have a foreign body, and that includes particulate matter, it sets the body up for inflammation. Inflammation is the substrate. In other words, it's the terrain for any kind of illness or disease. So when it goes into the brain, what it causes is neuroinflammation. And this is what we're seeing. We are seeing an increased risk associated with Parkinson's disease, with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and with dementias of all natures. We are also seeing an increased risk of psychosis in adolescents. And we are seeing in classic psychiatric illness, we are seeing an increase in association to bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, depression, anxiety, and obsessive compulsive disorder. We are also seeing, and this is increasingly well studied, in emergency rooms, we are seeing people showing up complaining of having anxiety attacks. That's the, when that oxygen, when you don't get oxygen, boy, can that trigger anxiety quickly, and with threats to commit suicide. And those numbers are out there. And we're going to be seeing those numbers more as time goes on, unfortunately. Inflammation generally sets you up for immune problems. It sets you up for cardiovascular problems. And it sets you up for memory, of course, problems. It can affect our ability to sleep. It can cause sleep problems, etc. But what's noteworthy, there are sometimes immediate effects that you can see. But it's not necessarily that you see the immediate effects. Many times, physical insults are the opening salvo to the creation of the disease. So these prolonged exposures are what are especially damaging.
Dr. Van Sessen, we've heard testimony this week about adverse childhood experiences, or ACEs. I'm wondering if you could just address specifically how ACEs are related to mental health injuries in children.
One of the important aspects of well understanding ACEs is something that wasn't necessarily, I think, well understood before. And that is that there is a lag time between an insult or a trauma, in this particular case, and when you see some of those impacts on us physically. So when we've talked about cardiovascular, for example, impacts, you don't see those right away. It's over time. So for children, the more traumatic events you experience, the more likely you will have the cumulative toll of the adverse childhood experiences. And just to cut to the chase, the more you are affected, the more likely you are to have illnesses generally, and that includes, of course, mental and physical, and the more likely you are to have an early death. And this has been very well studied and substantiated. And it is what will befall young people exposed to repeated traumas.
Can you tell us what happens on the brain level when there's exposure to repeated trauma or climate stress?
Yes. I'll try to make it real easy to understand, but this is, of course, as you can guess, an image of the brain. That is that you have pointed out your prefrontal cortex. That's like the situation room. That's the part of your brain that gets data from all the rest of the kind of yellow part of your brain, telling you where you are, what you're supposed to do, evaluates things with respect to your conscience, your good judgment about the conditions and all the rest. So that's the situation room, and it's flooded with data all the time. Now we got also the amygdala, and that's the fight or flight center. And that's the center that achieves prominence when you're under stress or threat of stress. So what happens when people are threatened and under stress over long periods of time or for short periods of time? If it's a short period of time, that's the way we're made. We're supposed to respond in an acute situation with the proper response. But when that red light on the dashboard is on all the time, telling you that you are under threat, here's what happens. The lights go down on the situation room and the lights go up on the fight or flight center, the amygdala. It's sort of like you go from having the situation room in the driver's seat to having the fight or flight center in charge. And think about it. We've all been under stress. We know we have to call back, say, look, I'm really sorry. I was just irritated because of this or under stress because of that. So think about it, though, when this is chronic, and you have some of the impacts, the behavioral changes, that what happens is when it's the amygdala that's in the driver's seat, the fight or flight, you're saying stuff that maybe be better not to say. You might be impulsive. You might be engaging in dangerous behaviors, misreading, etc. What happens is you got the prefrontal cortex, that's the situation room, pushed out of the driver's seat. Now we got an individual driving with the amygdala at the wheel. It can be a not very pretty ride.
Approximately when does the prefrontal cortex become fully developed?
It's after we hit the age of adulthood. It always reminds me of when parents have turned to their children and say, what were you thinking? And the kid will think, well, I wasn't thinking anything. That's right. Because that prefrontal cortex, that situation room, doesn't really mature completely until about, more scientists say, 25. It's so important because that's where we can have nuanced sense of judgment, where we have a moral sort of fiber, where we look at what others might need, and it lines up with what our conscience tells us to do. So we need people who are more attuned to nuances, empathic, and have a good conscience.
And can exposure to this long-term stress have damaging harms on especially young people's bodies?
It does. And we, Dr. Byron referred to it the other day. What is instructive is to note that these impacts can be delayed and mostly are delayed. You don't get the appearance of cardiovascular disease from stress. We know it, high blood pressure, heart rate, etc. You don't see that until down the road. But there are cardiovascular impacts to chronic stress. We know that. There are impacts on our immune system. And one of the things that is the cause of this stress is something called cortisol, which is a steroid. And everybody knows that when you've got an organ transplant, you take steroids to reduce your body's immune system ability to fight. So what happens is under these conditions of chronic stress, exposed to steroids, what you have are people predisposed to illnesses and to cancers. We also have impacts on our hormones many times. And this is really very problematic, of course, for some people, is that it affects fertility because it affects our hormones. And you'll often hear about people having trouble becoming pregnant. And it can be the stress of that extra dose of steroids. And as I said, sleep and so many other conditions.
Are youth more vulnerable to the impacts of climate change and specifically mental health impacts? Because
it's actually cumulative. Didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, I'll let him finish the question.
I'm just wondering specifically if youth are more vulnerable to mental health impacts.
Oh, yes, because the whole point is ACE is adverse childhood experiences. This is the depiction, really, of what happens with that cumulative toll of stress. So this is quintessentially regarding children. So the answer is a resounding yes. And, of course, the younger you are, the more likely you are to have the cumulative toll of stress.
Is it your opinion, Dr. Van Susteren, that the plaintiffs in this case are experiencing some impacts to their mental health consistent with those described in the scientific literature?
Yes.
Objection, Your Honor. Lack of foundation. Dr. Van Susteren has already testified that she is not diagnosed with plaintiffs or anything.
Like a little bit more foundation. I think she told us some of this, how she's making these determinations about this.
Dr. Van Susteren, have you heard anything from the plaintiffs, either the language in their complaint, the declarations, or their testimony this week to suggest that they're experiencing any mental health impacts related to climate change?
Yes. Well, we have here, first of all, Ricky, and you've all heard in the courtroom in this last week that Ricky has very much suffered from consequences of drought. There have been financial problems as the viability of the ranch is compromised. There have been dead animals on her land, her problems seeing that the animals are properly hydrated, etc. And she has said that she feels a profound sense of abandonment as a result of the impacts of the climate disruption and the fact that the defendants have not taken a proper action. And there's much more to say about Ricky, but we'll move on. And Grace, of course, has said that she watches coal trains pass by her house, and she knows that they are the etiology or the root cause. Burning coal is the root cause of the problems. I can't imagine how being that must feel, being traumatized every day looking at these things. And she feels betrayed by her government as a result, by the defendants as a result. And she has said very compellingly, and I really noticed how these plaintiffs love this state so much. It's amazing, being the mother of teenagers in not a so distant past, that these kids talk so glowingly of how much they love their state. So she looks at those glaciers disappearing and feels terrified. Saria, we've talked about the physical and we've talked about the emotional connection to the land. But what really is so sublime and exciting, I think, for us, perhaps at least me, not as wedded to the land as indigenous, is to hear Sariel talk about the spiritual connection. Her ancestors are buried there. Ideally, if her land is protected and not ruined, she will be. This is her lifeblood. This is who she is. You take that away from a person, you take that person's identity away from him or her. This has a profound impact. And we saw yesterday, Sariel started to cry when she noted that the community rallied around her to provide the money that was necessary for her to get a first-rate education. And it marked me so, as a profiler especially, that it was the idea that a community was supportive of her that would bring her to tears. And as I say, as a profiler, those are profoundly noteworthy gestures to see the effects of what community can mean. Micah. Of course, Micah has told us about his having been imprisoned in his basement because of smoke. And he's also told us very glowingly, and this is embedded in it, the sense of loss that can come, is that when he's out on the trail running around, when he's not having to stay in the house because of the wildfire smoke, he doesn't even want to listen to music. It's the music of the forest, the beautiful trees, it's nature. These kids love this state, and what it provides for them is something that is extraordinarily noteworthy, and it also implies what they stand to lose. They know it too. They look at those trees, and it is indisputable in my mind, and they've said so too. Who's next? What's next? Micah, by the way, has been suffering, he said, since he was 4 years old when he watched the movie Chasing Ice. So this is the leitmotif of Micah's life, trying to avoid the threat and fear of disruption. A badge named after Badger 2 Medicine, and he has described for us the importance of his being able to connect with his family, the experience of being in a healthy Montana. They even hunt and fish for their livelihoods. This is a unique experience and a potentially unique loss. And you may recall that Badge showed us not only the fires behind him, but the fact that the area out there which he was named was nothing but, I guess, I saw pine trees 100 feet tall, he said, that were gray. And that was the redolent place that he'd been named after. Imagine what that does to you. Olivia has spoken to us very, very compellingly. She has expressed herself that she is in despair. She has also said how hopeful she is, that she really hangs on to the possibility of hope, and that's the antidote to despair. But what is of particular concern to me is when I hear how hard she tries to reduce her carbon footprint by staying out of the car, by being on her bike, and things like that. And I think, my God, surely there are upstream impacts that we as adults, hearing how much she is suffering from this, will want to come in and protect her. Finally, Claire. Claire has told us, and this was among the more arresting stories, and I've heard a lot of arresting stories, but in middle school, and just think about what kind of cynicism in a middle schooler. She raises money for solar panels and says that they've reached their cap at a certain point, but instead has to be thrown back into the kitty, presumably for the use of fossil fuels to continue. She also has talked about the beauty of glaciers and the potential loss. And she has said that she feels terrified. And I believe, as with Olivia, this sense of whether or not, and this is something which I didn't mention about Olivia, but the quandary about whether or not it's right to bring children into a world like this. Well, what an unnatural dilemma for a young person. Surely people can make their own choice, but to have foisted on them a world that they can't depend on to be safe, and so they're wondering if it's ethical. So, you know, this is just a quick superficial thumbnail sketch of the range, abandonment, betrayal, despair, terror, very real consequences from these plaintiffs and from the state, the experience of living in the state that they love and they know is under severe threat.
I'm wondering, are you familiar with the Montana Environmental Policy Act or MEPA limitation?
Yes, I am familiar with it.
And what's your understanding of the MEPA limitation?
That it expressly forbids agencies and policymakers from considering the impacts of climate change when reviewing environmental projects.
And is it your opinion that plaintiffs' mental health injuries are related to the climate change exception to MEPA?
Yes, I do.
Is there a term for when governments let children down in this way?
There is. It is called institutional betrayal. And think about it. Universities, academic institutions, churches, and of course the state have special responsibilities, because with the privilege of power comes the responsibilities to protect the people that are within its purview. And picking out the state specifically, it is the job. This is the social contract. We pay taxes, we do this, we do all these other things, and we respond to the requirements of government because of that special relationship, that institutional power that we have. So here we have an instance where the power of the state to take care of these children, to protect them, which is essential. It is the core of the presence of the state in their lives and in all of our lives. Instead of protecting them, they're increasing the dangers.
Has there been any research connecting the concept of institutional betrayal to climate change?
Indeed, there has. And I had published in 2021 with co-authors in The Lancet, which is acknowledged to be a premier medical journal, a study on 10,000 young people ages 16 to 25 around the world, 10 countries. And we measured there in this survey their climate distress. And here's what we found. I'm just going to tease out four little pieces that I think are most relevant. And that is, number one, 3/4 of those 10,000 kids were very concerned about climate. Almost half of them said that it affected their daily lives. More than half say they feel doomed. And 2/3 of those 10,000 kids lay the blame firmly at the feet of government.
Do you think that any of the plaintiffs in this case feel these feelings of institutional betrayal as a result of the MEPA limitation?
I don't feel it. They've said it.
Dr. Van Susteren, are you aware that the MEPA limitation was recently amended?
I'm aware that MEPA was recently amended. I believe the limitation remains in place.
Does the existence of this MEPA limitation bolster your opinions related to the emotional impacts that the plaintiffs have described experiencing here?
I'll just try to be succinct and say yes.
In your opinion, Dr. Van Susteren, what would be the most effective remedy to help prevent further psychological harm to these plaintiffs?
Judge, and call for legal conclusion.
Well, I guess I'm interpreting as not a legal remedy necessarily. What's the remedy? I don't know.
I'll try to rephrase the question. If Dr. Van Susteren, in your opinion, what would be the most effective way to help the plaintiffs meant to help minimize or have the plaintiffs feel better about the emotional impacts that they described feeling?
There really is only one remedy, and that's to address the root cause.
What do you mean by the root cause?
It's the promotion of fossil fuels and the rulings within the state that expressly prohibit consideration of climate impacts.
Can't mental health experts provide services to improve mental health conditions?
You know, it's sort of like saying, if the roof leaks, should you just buy more paint so you can cover up where it's leaking? Yeah, you can do little things on the outside, but it doesn't change anything. It might present a little bit of a band-aid, but that's not going to heal any of the conditions.
Earlier, Dr. Van Susteren, you mentioned that you're an author of the 2003 paper Assessing Dangerous Climate Change. Is that right?
That's correct.
And did you rely on this paper in forming your opinions in this case?
I did.
And is this the type of study reasonably relied upon by experts in your field?
Indeed it is.
And was it peer-reviewed?
Up one side of the street and down the other.
Can you please identify the key conclusions of this paper?
Yes. That we must reach zero emissions by 2050 and that we must reach 350 parts per million as a result of our work by the end of the century for our, and I will underscore this word, salvation.
Your Honor, this paper has been marked as Plaintiff's Exhibit P21, and I would like to move it into evidence at this time.
Objection, cumulative.
Your Honor, if I may, this is really one of the gold standard papers for identifying the standard for protecting the environment, human health, physical health, emotional health. It's been peer-reviewed. It's been authored by Dr. Van Susteren, other leading climate scientists like Dr. James Hansen, and I believe it also qualifies as a learned treatise.
All right. I will admit P21.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just one final question, Dr. Van Susteren. In your opinion, how will the outcome of this case impact plaintiffs' mental health?
It will be determinative, frankly, in many ways. We are at a fork in the road. The kids know what is at stake, and they know what we have to do. And you have on one side of the spectrum that we will be headed towards further damage, darkness, challenges, and trauma, and the attendant emotional toll that comes with that. Or on the other hand, I believe that if they prevail here in this case today, that sense of hope that all these plaintiffs have been talking about and the belief that there are reasons to hope, because hope is not something you pound the table. Hope comes from having legitimate reasons to think things are going to get better. So it's a night and day impact on their mental health. Either things are going to get worse and they will increasingly sense the feeling of helplessness, or instead here we are bringing to them the possibility that the necessary changes are going to be made and their lives will be able to have the healthy, joyful character that they seek and certainly deserve.
Thank you, Dr. Van Susteren. I have no further questions.
Ross?
Good afternoon, Dr. Van Susteren.
Good afternoon.
Welcome to Montana again. Just picking up where we left off a moment ago, is it your impression that the plaintiff's mental health is the core issue of this case?
It is a factor. Yes, the case is the actions of the defendants and the impact of the deeds and policies of the defendants on the mental health of these plaintiffs.
In other words, what I'm getting at, it's not just a side issue. It's the essence of why we're here, as far as your understanding is concerned.
Well, could you give me an indication of what you mean by a side issue?
Well, I don't know if I can do it without confusing things further, so I'll leave it at that. You said at the outset that you have not diagnosed any of the plaintiffs with any of the things you've talked about here today. Is that accurate?
That's accurate.
Have you appeared in a court of law before and testified like you are today about the mental health of anyone without having made a diagnosis?
Yes, I believe I have.
Can you give me an example?
Yes, a case in which a person was claiming emotional damages after a surgical error and another emotional damages with respect to a botched biopsy. Another one was a sexual harassment case. Well, those are the three that come to mind.
And any of those, were you advocating for the damages that the party was alleging, or were you on the other side of the case?
I've been on both sides.
Well, in those three cases specifically, Dr. Van Susteren, did you discuss the alleged damages? First of all, in all three of those, I think your testimony is you discussed the alleged damages without having made a diagnosis on any of them.
Correct.
And were you doing that on behalf of those parties on their side of the case?
Well, no. In the first case, I was working for the defendants. In the second case, I was working for the plaintiffs. In the third case that I had referred to, I was working for the defendant.
So in two of the three, you were called upon to testify in opposition to their claim of damages.
Correct.
But in another one, you were on their side. Is that a fair way to put it?
That's correct. That's my record, to the best of my ability. It's been a number of years.
Are there ethical rules for your profession that pertain to when you should make a diagnosis versus when you don't need to, if you're going to be discussing the condition of a certain individual?
I am not aware that there are other than that there are prescribed ethical considerations. The ethical consideration is that you, as the expert, speak the truth as far as you know it. That's the ethical consideration. And I've turned cases down where I didn't believe that I could be ethically, that I could be honest about what I was hearing and finding. So I would not take a case under those circumstances.
Did I hear you correctly at the beginning, and please tell me if I'm mistaken, that you believe you are an advocate for the plaintiffs in this case? Is that an accurate statement?
Let me put it this way so that we make sure that it doesn't get tarnished in any way with any potential to impute something. Advocate is literally to speak for. So I do believe that my role here is to speak for the plaintiffs.
About their mental health specifically, fair?
About, well, not their mental health specifically. It's specifically about how the actions of the state affect their mental health.
Correct. And to describe to the court your impression of their mental health without having diagnosed anything on that subject. Is that fair?
Well, do recall that people use these terms kind of interchangeably, and we'll talk about psychological health and well-being and things like that. But if you notice, when I was asked in the opening statements about what I was being asked to do, I did refer to the emotional toll on the plaintiffs, young people, and future generations of Montanans. And I did specifically tug out the MEPA climate exception and the impact, the emotional toll I've not referred to the diagnosis here and don't feel that it's necessary.
I did hear you say that. And I guess as a layperson, I believed it was sort of interchangeable with mental health, emotional toll. Not so?
It is used interchangeably, but of course, everything has connotations. And people tend to use fancier words when they're going to use diagnostic terms. But I prefer use terms that people, ordinary lay people, can understand. And they don't have to wade through something that they might not as easily respond and understand.
We end today's show with the final words of the plaintiff's case, the testimony of Kalispell Youth plaintiff Lander Bussey.
It's been a really hard week in the courtroom. Just having what we have been having to deal with, both mentally and physically, for the last few years, validated in the courtroom by professionals who have dedicated their whole lives and careers free of charge to us to assist us in helping the place that we love so dearly. And it's been really difficult just to watch how dire of a situation this is be put on full display. And equally as frustrating as that is knowing the place we're in as a state to be able to stop these problems. Mr. Erickson remarked on how we could be having a much different conversation in the courtroom as Montana, as a leader in stopping fossil fuel emissions and saving this environment. Thank God that it's Montana that gets here first, because I can't stand to see this place that I and so many people love and use so dearly be put to such waste at this point. It's been really difficult. And I don't know how you can sit in this courtroom and listen to everything that is put on display here and not have a semblance of regret or even responsibility to get up and fix these things that we have been told firsthand can be fixed. It's been really difficult, but I am optimistic. And I'm so proud of the work that our team and the plaintiffs have been able to accomplish. It just makes me very proud.
As proud as it makes you feel, Lander, how does the fact that Montana state law requires Montana's agencies to ignore greenhouse gas emissions and climate change when conducting environmental reviews for fossil fuel permits, how does that make you feel?
I don't know how you can sit in this courtroom at all and to listen to these experts, and not just the evidence, but the pleas that they have. Dr. Stanford and Dr. Runny remarked on how they'd never seen such language in reports such as these for the direness of the situation. And the state has one job, to look out for us. I can't really believe that this much can be put on display in a court of law. And yet still we can be so vigorously shut down by a government that doesn't respect our right to the legal process. We have been almost shut down from getting into court 8 times, whether that be through the court itself or through the Supreme Court trying to get our case dismissed. The state government did not even want us to have our day in court, let alone for the facts to be presented about how detrimental this is to everyone in the state. It's just another clear example of the government putting profits before the people that it is supposed to serve. And it's so frustrating and disappointing to see it on such a wide and systematic level, as we've seen in the last few days. So I can't speak to the exact emotions of Governor Gianforte or Attorney General Knudsen towards our case, but the statements towards our case and everything that we've worked so hard for these last 3 weeks have been nothing short of disrespectful, vicious, and wrong, and completely disregarding what this state and its constitution were initially ratified for. So I'm very disappointed, but I'm still optimistic that this may be some catalyst for change.
Thank you, Andrew.
You have just heard the final testimony as the plaintiffs rest their case in Held v. State of Montana, the testimony of Kalispell Youth plaintiff Lander Bussey. Before that, the testimony of Dr. Lisa Van Susteren, internationally recognized psychiatrist and expert on how climate change affects the physical and mental health of youth differently and more drastically than adults. Echotones and Forthright Radio are Beyond the Deep End Productions, hosted and produced by Joy LaClaire. You can hear our ongoing Echotones coverage of the historic Held v. State of Montana trial by going to our website, forthright.media. They are also archived kgvm.org. Thanks to Renee Keating for production assistance with these broadcasts. We will continue to record and produce daily audio digests as the State of Montana presents their defense this coming week. This is Joy LaClaire, signing out for now.